So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio.
Welcome to our weekly marriage hour here on Trending. It is great to be with you. Normally during our marriage hour, we unpack a number of topics relating to dating, marriage, discernment, and today we're going to take a little bit different of a direction. I yesterday broke down my analysis after watching oral arguments of the Dobbs versus Jackson Supreme Court case that opened up yesterday before the Supreme Court addressing the issue of abortion, the case coming out of Mississippi having to do with viability. And the big question is, what will happen? We have 6 months of waiting until normally when the Supreme Court will deliver its opinion, its decision on the Supreme Court case. So we have 6 months of waiting ahead of us, and that's a long time. But there's much that we can do in the meantime. Today, I want to finish my analysis. We didn't have enough time to make it through the full thing of what happened yesterday during the hearing. And I think this is really important for us to understand what occurred during oral arguments yesterday before the Supreme Court doesn't even scratch the surface as to what will go on over the next 6 months, and even prior to yesterday's oral arguments. The Supreme Court justices together will be deliberating, having conversations back and forth, even potentially looking to compromises. So it's important that we are praying for them and that we don't put too much weight on what was said yesterday during oral arguments before the Supreme Court in Dobbs versus Jackson. You're listening to Trending with Tim Ray here on Relevant Radio. I want to give you a taste of the scene we saw before the Supreme Court. I want to share with you a little bit of audio that came yesterday from actually Father Frank Pavone, who's a huge pro-life advocate. And what we are going to be hearing here is the shocking reality of what we're up against in terms of the culture of death. At the end of the day, because this is what it is. Many pro-abortion as well as pro-lifers rallied on the steps of the Supreme Court, and three pro-abortion advocates stood out in front of the Supreme Court, and they stood there taking abortion pills to kill their children live in front of thousands of people. Listen to this audio. Chant led by three women on the steps of the Supreme Court. And what do those three women do together? As they chant abortion pills forever, rallying the crowd, they also then, each of them, take the abortion pill, in effect, to kill their unborn children. I just can't imagine what it's like that three women can stand in public with smiles on their faces, proud to kill their children in the name of so-called freedom, or as we've seen before the Supreme Court this week, that the pro-abortion attorneys who presented in oral arguments before the Supreme Court justices, that their argument was freedom. They weren't talking about privacy, autonomy, or choice. It was freedom. And they don't even want to address whether or not the initial decision of Roe versus Wade was wrong or not. They actually even acknowledge, even if it was an outrageously wrong decision with no constitutional standing, 50 years later, they're saying it doesn't matter. It's what allows women to have freedom. So I want to continue to unpack some of what we're seeing here before the Supreme Court. You see, yesterday, before the Supreme Court, was a historic day. It was the beginning of truly what I believe will be the reversal of the Supreme Court's decision to somehow create a right to kill a baby. And decades later, this is going to be the reversal of decades upon decades of damage to women, harm to marriages, perpetual adolescence in men due to lost fatherhood, and the loss of countless children, millions of children in the United States. In fact, just those numbers that are reported, and many of which are not reported or required to be reported in most states, we know of at least almost 70 million abortions here in the United States. We know one of the most common forms of abortion for many years now has been the RU-46 mifepristone abortion pill. And that, in the vast majority of states, is not reported on at all. So these numbers we have are hard to even fathom. We hear things such as 1 in 4 women will have an abortion, 1 in 4 babies are aborted. But that barely scratches the surface in helping us to understand the full magnanimity of what has occurred when it's come to abortion. And this is why we're talking about it during our weekly Marriage Hour here on Trending, because we're going to discuss a little later on one of the arguments made before the Supreme Court having to do with abortion and the choice of person that you will marry. But I want to continue my analysis. I watched all of the oral arguments yesterday, and there's much to be said. If you weren't with me, I want to highly encourage you to subscribe to Trending on whatever podcasting platform you love to listen to. Share the episode with a friend. Help people. You know, this is an opportunity. You don't even have to necessarily say what you think. Say, hey, here's a commentary and oral arguments before the Supreme Court on abortion. What do you think? So you can share that and find that. Easiest way to listen is on Relevant Radio app, but we are wherever you like to listen to podcasts. Now, I've mentioned there are 3 people who presented before the Supreme Court. Yesterday, I spent most of my time talking about Scott Stewart, who is a Mississippi Solicitor General. He's the one representing the pro-life position for the state of Mississippi. Now, I wanted to unpack more of Julie Reichelman's comment. She's a senior director for the Center for Reproductive Rights, and she's the one who represented Jackson Women's Health, which is the abortion clinic, the only abortion clinic in Mississippi. In fact, I was just in Mississippi a couple months ago, and I was actually in Jackson. It's kind of crazy to think about. This is where history is occurring right now. Now, here's the reality. Julie Reichelman, when specifically addressing the Mississippi Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health case, claims that the restrictions placed on abortion by the Mississippi case, the Mississippi law, is unconstitutional. So, brief kind of overview, if you don't know what this Mississippi law in question is that's presenting the opportunity to challenge Roe, this court case is the law that was implemented in Mississippi a couple of years ago that basically states that abortion is banned after 15 weeks. Why is that a problem? Why did that go to the Supreme Court? Well, currently, the line drawn in the sand in terms of when you can put restrictions on abortion actually settles in right around 22 weeks when viability is currently defined as. So that's currently the line drawn in the sand by Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, that follow-up case in 1992. And so basically what Julie Reichelman starts with emphasizing, this is unconstitutional, what's happening in Mississippi, claiming that it forces women to remain pregnant and give birth against their will. Now, this is fascinating to me because it completely ignores the fact that, A, there's a child there, and ignoring the fact that, I'm sorry, no one ever talks about this, but it's important to recognize that abortions changed our culture. People forget that consenting to sex actually does mean there's a potential for a child. People will say they consented to sex, but they didn't consent to pregnancy, or they didn't consent to a baby. And so this is why, in fact, and we'll talk about this in just a moment, Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett actually ends up calling out Reichelman, specifically addressing the topic of, well, do you really need this much access to abortion when we have safe haven laws and rigorous access to adoption that is available that wasn't available in the same way as before? And here's the thing that's scary about the pro-abortion movement. They don't care about these types of access, and we'll see that in a moment when I address the response that Reichelman gave to Justice Barrett. So Reichelman's whole argument representing the pro-abortion side really emphasized rights for women to end their pregnancy, pre-viability, as the rule of law. So they came in emphasizing that the Mississippi law is unconstitutional, is what they claim. And then they also claim that viability must be the rule. That is the line in the sand when it comes to when restrictions can begin to be placed on abortion. You see, that's the problem with the Mississippi law. It's placing a restriction on abortion prior to that current line in the sand of viability. The law was written intentionally to be a challenge to Roe versus Wade and to go to the Supreme Court. So what Reichelman's insisting upon is that the state shouldn't take control of a woman's body, life, or liberty. She actually, when confronted by Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, who tries to ask her, you know, are you arguing from the perspective of autonomy or privacy that we saw in the prior abortion cases? She insists not, that she's actually arguing from the perspective of freedom, bodily integrity, making free decisions about marriage, family, and childbearing. I'll touch on that again in just a moment. Well, let's just touch on it here for a second now, because I think it's important. What Reichelman is claiming, along with the pro-abortion Supreme Court justices, as well as the other pro-abortion advocate that came before the Supreme Court, if you're not familiar with her, it's actually United States Solicitor General Elizabeth Preliger, who very clearly emphasizes, again, the same ideas of the importance of women having access to abortion as a fundamental part of participating, being a functioning and participating member of society. That's at the heart of really the pro-abortion argument today, that they need abortion in order to make any sort of self-determination, is basically what they're saying, that this is fundamental to being free. This is why we're seeing they're trying to take up language that you would hear coming out of, for example, the civil rights movement. But they're wrong because they're ignoring the humanity of the child that's present. An ability, an emphasis to give themselves rights, so-called rights, they're eliminating and disregarding and dehumanizing the child in the womb. And so what Reichelman comes back to in addressing specifically the Mississippi case is that she's insistent that the state shouldn't take control of a woman's body, life, and liberty. And this is what's kind of silly, and I think we need to be able to respond to this. She makes it sound as if by carrying a child to term, as if that is going to ruin a woman's life forever. And I think that this is the problem that our culture has. Multiple generations of children have been indoctrinated and manipulated into believing that pregnancy is the worst possible thing that could happen for your future. The pregnancy, that a baby, ruins your future. Doesn't allow you to do anything from education to career to choosing what type of marital status you will have, who you will marry, or for that matter, how many children you will have down the road. You see, this is a problem of the culture. Women and men, for that fact, are being scared into believing that babies ruin your life. And this is the narrative that we're up against. This is the narrative that was essentially taken before the Supreme Court yesterday during oral arguments on the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health case. And the claim at the end of the day is this: if abortion is taken away, it will propel women backward. They will no longer be properly functioning members of society. Now, Reichelman goes in to emphasize by trying to prove her point that it will propel women backward because 1 in 4 women have abortions today. She claims it will hurt poor people, that it will hurt people with health issues, that it will hurt youth who take longer to recognize that they're pregnant, that laws such as the Mississippi law banning abortion after 15 weeks will hurt all of these populaces of people, ignoring the fact that the pro-abortion movement has hurt each and every single one of these groups. Starting with the 1 in 4 women who have had abortions, what about all the women who regret their lost motherhood, their lost child? What about post-abortion syndrome, leading to everything from suicide, substance abuse, depression, anxiety, and difficulty in future relationships? Even the argument that young people need abortion because it takes them longer to recognize they're pregnant. Well, isn't that so sad? Because we know the later in a pregnancy that a person has an abortion, the more upsetting and damaging it can be for them, because the more they acknowledge the baby because of the growth and the changes in their body. So what she's saying is that we should still push access to abortion for young people in later stages in the pregnancy, even though we know statistically that later abortions do more damage to the person who has the abortion, and they're also more dangerous. She also ignores the fact that the poor have been targeted by the greater abortion movement, and not just the poor, but various races as well. Planned Parenthood founder Margaret Sanger intentionally talked over and over again about eugenics, about doing away with lesser breeds of people, people she thought who were less than. Specifically the Black community, the Hispanic communities. And in fact, to this day, abortion clinics are more readily available and present within minority communities. And so this is why I think people such as Clarence Thomas come back at her right away and say, well, what argument are you trying to make? Because here's the problem with the pro-abortion arguments made before the court yesterday. They weren't sound legal arguments. They were cultural arguments that you and I need to engage in, but they weren't quite the arguments that needed to be heard before the Supreme Court. And that's what's important that we understand. Their arguments were not good. They were a mess. Now, they may have sounded eloquent, really eloquent. They may have represented the cultural debate, but they did not do a good job of representing the pro-abortion stance before the Supreme Court legally. Now, one of the responses that Julie Reichelman for the senior director for the Center for Reproductive Rights made is that women's decisions need to be available until viability, and that the state should not be able to regulate or put restrictions on abortion until after viability. But this is the question at the heart of the entire debate. And we'll see in just a moment here, many of the justices kept coming back to this idea of viability. In fact, we saw even the Chief Justice came back over and over and over again, turning to her, wanting her to clarify what she thought about the whole issue of viability. Though this is actually very promising that Chief Justice John Roberts kept coming back to this idea of viability. He wanted to address viability along with some of the other Supreme Court justices that people are concerned might be wishy-washy on this issue. They were concerned about viability. From Neil Gorsuch to Chief Justice John Roberts, the question of viability is a big one, and it's at the heart of the entire issue. And here's the problem. Everyone knows that viability is fungible. In other words, viability changes. Viability changes, especially within the context of new medical technologies, advancements, and even world records that were just reached in the last year by a baby who survived 21 weeks pre-viability. Did you know that if a child's prior to viability born, that a medical professional isn't required to do anything to try and save that baby's life? It's perfectly legal for them to leave the baby on the other side of the room and not fight for the baby at all because of abortion laws. This is how horrible our abortion laws are. I've talked to countless nurses within the context of emergency rooms where a child was birthed prematurely, and the nurses, under instruction from other medical individuals, were told to leave the baby in the corner of the room to die while the baby is literally moving and wiggling, and anything that could be done should be done to try and help save that baby's life to the best of our ability. You see, these are things that are so important that we acknowledge and discuss and recognize behind the scenes when it comes to the abortion issue. And this is why I'm breaking down so many of the oral arguments. If you're just joining me, you're listening to Trending with Timmeri here on Relevant Radio, and we're discussing oral arguments yesterday. I did an hour breaking down the oral arguments, and we're finishing them today. Now, I briefly want to come to comments made by Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Now, she addressed the pro-abortion Representative Reichelman, and she asked her, why don't safe haven laws help the parental burden argument? In other words, Justice Barrett talks about how in the Supreme Court cases of Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, both of them focus on the topic of the burden of parenthood. Now, I find this fascinating that the woman on the court with many children is coming up addressing specifically the parental burden argument that's being made over and over again. And she's saying, why don't safe haven laws, as well as access to adoption, come up in your comments when it comes to parental burden arguments? If you don't know what safe haven laws are, in the vast majority of states, women can actually, after giving birth, and in some states, up to a month, up to 42 hours, up to 78 hours, can actually go and surrender their baby to anything such as a police station, a fire station, a hospital even. Surrender their child, and that child will be taken care of and sent and placed with a family to be adopted. No questions asked. And so Justice Barrett is commenting on how we've seen many laws implemented throughout the nation giving access for women to safely surrender their children and therefore alleviate the burden of parenthood, which is often discussed. Now, what was interesting is Reichelman, in part of her response, kept emphasizing the need for bodily integrity. In other words, having the ability to choose what you want to choose with your body, but then she also mentioned decisional autonomy. In other words, the ability to make whatever decision you want, no matter the consequences, and no matter, in this case, if you kill a child or not. You're listening to Trending with Tim right here on Relevant Radio. I'll continue during our weekly marriage hour here and relate the issue to a marriage. What happened before the Supreme Court on the abortion case of Dobbs versus Jackson? Don't go away. You can ask your question live on social media now.
So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timmery on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Great to be with you. I'm Timmer. You're listening to Relevant Radio. I'm finishing my analysis that I started yesterday. I spent a full hour discussing the Supreme Court case addressing abortion, Dobbs versus Jackson Women Health, the case coming out of Mississippi. If you missed it, please go and listen. It's a really good overview of what's happening. And I'm wrapping up that analysis now. And we're going to talk about things you've heard a lot probably about everything from stare decisis to everything such as undue burden. I'm going to re-go through some of those items. And I'm also going to discuss how abortion has changed the status of marriage in our nation. It's completely changed marriage. And in fact, there was actually an argument made before the court. I want you to listen to some of the audio where that was actually discussed. We'll come to that in just a moment. Before we go there, I think that it's fascinating as we're looking at some of the arguments made before the Supreme Court. Over and over again, all the pro-abortion movement could really do in with their attorneys, not even making sound legal arguments, they kept coming back time and time again to the idea of women being participating members in society only via access to abortion. Now, Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett ends up calling out Julie Reichelman, the director for the Center for Reproductive Rights, representing the abortion side, and she calls her out basically saying, so what I'm hearing from you over and over again, I'm paraphrasing here, is basically access to abortion for the sake of professional opportunity. Things such as, you know, career advancement, socioeconomic impact of having a child, the parental burden. And Reichelman comes back, and I was mentioning this a moment ago, with two things. Because she doesn't want to say those words. She doesn't want to say that, yes, I'm promoting abortion for the sake of professional opportunity to eliminate the socioeconomic impact of having a child. She comes in and says, it's about bodily integrity and decisional autonomy. In other words, it's about having the opportunity, the choice to do whatever you want with your body, Which is a lie, because I'm sorry, it's not your body, because in that state, you'd have two noses, four eyes, four ears, and even, you know what, for a moment, maybe we could believe in this whole transgender movement, you'd also, half the time, even be two sexes. I mean, according to her bodily integrity, my body, my choice argument, it's the same thing. So that's completely debunked. It's not your body. The second thing is she mentioned decisional autonomy. In other words, this choice to make whatever decision I want, even if that means ending the life of another human person, so that I can choose whatever profession I want, career, education, whether or not I want the burden of parenthood. You know, the argument didn't go that far, but the fact that Justice Barrett, for just a moment, stopped and called Reichelman out on the selfishness of the pro-abortion argument, I thought was extremely profound, especially coming from one woman to another woman. From one incredibly talented, successful, and intelligent attorney, now on the Supreme Court of the United States, who has a wonderful marriage and many children, to then this radical pro-abortion advocate who's trying to make it sound as if you can't live your life unless you have abortion as a woman. That you are not free unless you have abortion. So that was kind of, I think, a little highlight moment of, again, this woman-to-woman argument occurring before the Supreme Court about the fact that the pro-abortion movement's making this all about professional opportunity. Type of living they want. And this is what's at the heart of it. But as I said before, there were some promising comments made by some of the Supreme Court justices that people have been a little concerned about where they would end up standing in the end. Justice Neil Gorsuch seemed to focus a lot on the undue burden issue and the vagueness of this. If you don't know what an undue burden is, in 1992, in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the issue of an undue burden was addressed, and it was brought up that even though you can create restrictions on abortion, you can regulate abortion access, you cannot create any, quote, undue burden to a woman in accessing abortion. So what that did is that even if there's a law prohibiting abortion at a certain stage, if a woman uses this undue burden phrasing to access an abortion federally, the law trumps and she's allowed access to an abortion. And so what Gorsuch was insisting upon is that both the idea of an undue burden, which is vague, as well as viability and that line being drawn in the sand as to when we can actually put restrictions on abortion, that these things need to be clarified. Now, Justice Alito also emphasized viability as well and the arbitrariness of it, that today it's 22 weeks, but next year it could be 20 weeks because of medical technologies. And that's what's so important that we recognize. So as I'm kind of wrapping this up here, I want to just give you kind of the summary of this whole idea before going into one argument about how abortion relates to marriage. You're going to hear a lot about stare decisis. And stare decisis is this precedence rule that the court has. This idea that basically, and again, this is something that Justice Breyer, one of the liberal justices, continued to come back to. That is the court's principle that the ruling should stand, that is past rulings such as Planned Parenthood versus Casey, and before that Roe versus Wade, unless there is a due and adequate reason to reverse the decision. Well, guess what? There is a due and adequate reason to reverse the decision. Now, the reason why so much emphasis is put on stare decisis is because they're insisting upon keeping the precedents as is, not changing the status quo, because that would undermine the reputation of the court. That would go back on prior cases. Well, things have been done on this before, such as having to do with slavery, such as having to do even with gay marriage. It used to be that it was insistent that the court emphasized that states can actually regulate gay marriage. And then all of a sudden we have, not that long ago, the Supreme Court of Hodges having to do with, oh, well, all of a sudden we as a court decide, again, legislating from the benches. So here's the reality. There are two important things to recognize. There is a due and adequate reason to reverse Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. One, because there is absolutely no constitutional right to abortion. And this is why the pro-abortion movement has had terrible legal arguments before the Supreme Court. And two, Roe versus Wade created a license to kill. That is unheard of. And this is why it needs to be done away with. And this is why some of the opening arguments that were so excellent coming from Scott Stewart, the Mississippi Solicitor General, were very good. Poor guy, I mentioned yesterday, he seemed so nervous. And you know, he didn't take the bait on some of the attacks made or some of the pro-abortion arguments. And yeah, he could have done much stronger in some areas, but he emphasized the core idea. It's not a constitutional right, and we created a license to kill, and that's unacceptable, and that horrific damage that's been done to our nation needs to be undone. So with that, talking about the arguments made by Scott Stewart for the pro-life side of Mississippi State, the emphasis had to do with kicking the idea out of the Constitution. It was invented, it isn't there. Abortion is not constitutional. He also proposed essentially this position of neutrality, which some of the judges seemed to really like. And that is that the court couldn't in 1973 and can't today solve the issue of abortion. That this issue needs to go back to the states. And so he's encouraging a position of neutrality by sending it back to the states and reversing the prior decisions. But he also brings up something very important, that what Roe versus Wade did was it created a right to kill. And that needs to be addressed. And that is something, if addressed in this case, which I don't necessarily believe that it will be, that is something we will continue to see a battle over the years to come that could be an overlying issue that will help to continue to push forward pro-life stances in various states. As we'll see, Roe versus Wade's undone. Individual states decide what they want to do with abortion, but then we'll take abortion yet again to the Supreme Court, because at the end of the day, abortion creates a right to kill. And that is not something we can find in our Constitution. And that is something that needs to be addressed. And that's why we have to talk about personhood and the value of human life. So those are the main arguments summarizing coming from the pro-life position represented by the state of Mississippi. The pro-abortion arguments, to summarize, coming from Elizabeth Preliger for the United States Solicitor General, as well as Julie Reichelman for the Center for Reproductive Rights, focuses on two things. One, to remain with the precedents, that is a stare decisis, of the past two cases that created a right to abortion. So in other words, leave things as they are, don't do anything. The second legal argument they made really was that women depend upon the right to abortion, so don't take it away or else they're going backwards. That they need to be allowed continued so-called freedom, that abortion is what's necessary supposedly to be free. So this whole, I think, summary, kind of looking big picture, it's what's happened before the Supreme Court. There's a lot of hope here. The fact that some of the justices that were maybe we were worrying about a little bit, that they're really thinking about these issues, such as the importance of neutrality of the court or precedence, that it's okay that precedence isn't maintained when something outrageously wrong has been done by the court. And so I think that the question now is, what do you and I do from here? We've got 6 months until a final decision is usually made in June by the Supreme Court, and we'll hear not only their decision, but their opinions on the issue. It's quite a while. Now, let's say in June, Roe versus Wade is overruled. There's no constitutional right to abortion, and the issue goes back to the states. That means we have a state-to-state battle. That means that now, before that happens, we need to be on the ground engaging in these cultural arguments, hearts and minds. So that can start today. While this is a hot button topic before everyone, the first thing you can do is share this episode as well as yesterday's podcast, where I do an analysis of the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health court case on abortion. Share this episode. Share your thoughts, what you think, or share, hey, what do you think? Here's one analysis. This, you can find that by going to relevantradio.com/trending to share this episode, or texting it to a friend, posting on social media, by posting a link from wherever you like to listen to your podcasts. We're there. Second thing I want to encourage you to do is, this is a battle that we must pray first and foremost in. And watching those three women in front of the Supreme Court, on the steps of the Supreme Court yesterday, taking abortion pills while people took videos of them for them to kill their babies and chanting and smiling while doing this, it's demonic. It's wicked. It is evil. And the evil has taken control of so many people in our nation. People have been fed the lie that abortion is necessary to be a participating member of society. We need to pray for a conversion of hearts and minds. We need to pray for the sacrifice that is truly made to the devil, that it needs to be abolished. The third thing I want to encourage you to do is to educate yourself so that you can have the conversations necessary. Time and time again, I've spoken to people who have been pro-life their entire lives, and they say, I didn't know that was what abortion was when you tell me that. And so that's why it's so important that we're able to describe, give details and stories. So that my fourth thing that we can do, so that we can engage the argument by having that education and by going forward with Christ. And I don't always know what to say. People can throw difficult questions my way, but here's what we're called to do. We are called to prayerfully go forth. Pray the prayer, come Holy Spirit, that he will help us, and he surely will, to know what to say, how to respond, and even humbly at times to say, I don't know exactly. You're listening to Trending with Timory here on Relevant Radio. A couple of the questions that have come in. If you have a question, feel free to send it my way, 1-888-914-9149. Or you can join me live now on Instagram and ask your question. Follow me at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. A caller asked, what percentage of abortions are because of women's health and for rape instances? Less than 1% of all abortions are because of a woman's health, rape, or incest. Less than 1%. It's important that we recognize that. You and I know, and maybe we need to talk about this a day soon, that rape and a woman's health are not reasons to have an abortion. They're not solutions. And we can talk about that more another day. One, it does more damage to the healing for a woman. It causes her to identify more with the perpetrator than as a victim when she has an abortion. For women's health, early delivery is an option, not the intentional killing of a child. So that 1%, for some reason, we allow that to be the primary reason why we make excuses for allowing access to abortion. And I think sometimes when we're having conversations with people, sometimes if they can't get over the woman's health and the rape argument, maybe they need to say, we need to say to them, pretend for a moment you and I agree on what should be done in the cases of rape and women's health. Pretend for a second. Let's set that aside. Let's talk about the other 99% of all abortions that are occurring for elective reasons, for whatever reason people choose. So that's one way, if someone can't get over those two topics and agree with you, that you can set that aside and talk about all the other 99% of all abortions. And remember, we're approaching 70 million abortions. Those are the ones that are documented. Most abortions are not. The other question that came in, what is the percentage of married women who have abortions? A great question. I know there was a study that came out of Canada back in the 90s. I'm sure there's more coming out. I know back then when abortion numbers were at a real height in terms of surgical abortions, that 1 in 4 women who are having abortions were married. Today, I'm not sure what that number looks like. We have fewer marriages than ever before, and a lot of our abortions are occurring via medication abortions, and we don't have stats on that. So, even the stats we do have, they're not as accurate as they could be. Great questions. Coming back, I'm going to talk about hope. It's the first week of Advent, and our theme is hope. I think it's an important topic this week. I'm also going to briefly touch on, during our marriage hour today, how abortion impacts the choice of your partner as well as marriage. I'll be right back here on Trending with Timory, heard on Relevant Radio. Follow me on social media at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Welcome back to our weekly marriage hour here on Trending. We've been unpacking talking the last analysis of the Supreme Court case addressing abortion in this nation. We'll come back to that. If you want to hear that, you can find it on the podcast for today as well as yesterday's show. I spent a full hour on it. Relevantradio.com/trending to subscribe and share the episode with other people. I want to address one of the arguments made during oral arguments. I was flabbergasted that what was said, but this is also what's said every day by the pro-abortion movement. The United States Solicitor General Elizabeth Preliger commented about choosing the people that you will marry, your sexual partners, etc. And this is what she said. It had to do in response to one of the Supreme Court justices' questions. I think it was Elena Kagan, having to do with the reliance argument. That is, that women are reliant on abortion in order to be functioning, participating members of society. Listen to Elizabeth Preliger's response.
As I think Casey correctly recognized, Casey pointed to the individual reliance of women and their partners who had been able to organize their lives and make important life decisions against the backdrop of having control over this incredibly consequential decision whether to have a child. And people make decisions in reliance on having that kind of reproductive control, decisions about where to live, what relationships to enter into, what investments to make in their jobs and careers. And so I think on a very individual level, there has been profound reliance. And it's certainly the case that not every woman in America has needed to exercise this right or has wanted to, but one in four American women have had an abortion, and for those women, the right secured by Roe and Casey has been critical in ensuring that they can control their bodies.
Okay, you heard what she was saying there about how, yes, women are reliant on abortion, and that reliance on abortion, they use abortion to determine their choice of partners. Not just what sort of education or not just what sort of career, but who they will engage in intimate acts with, who they will marry. You see, this is very, very important that we understand how intensely abortion has impacted marriage. Abortion completely changed how men and women relate to one another, how they date, how they engage in intimacy, and how they raise families. This is where we've actually even seen a crisis today of the unmarried. People who want to get married but can't find a spouse. Why? Perpetual adolescence in men because they've been let off the hook in terms of expectations. We've seen this in terms of women seeking careers. You see these pro-abortion attitudes that has created this attitude that marriage isn't necessary because kids don't always result. It's very important that we understand that. Contraception and abortion, we're talking about contraception tomorrow on Trending, has led to this idea that marriage isn't necessary because kids don't always result from it. That is, kids don't always result from intimacy. You see, kids are part of the glue that holds a marriage together. Marriage is for the sake of a safe haven for children. This is why fewer people are getting married. This is why they believe we've evolved beyond marriage. You see, when you take babies out of sex and sex out of marriage, you then leave no protection for the child. You completely lose sight of what sex is for. You lose sight of protection for women, especially unwed mothers. And there's no protection whatsoever for marriage. You see, the type of spouses people look for today has been completely flipped upside down because of abortion on both ends of the spectrum. This has led to a crisis for young people who have been lied to. You see, we have a generation after generation of unmarriable men who are living in perpetual adolescence. We have cold career women who men don't want to marry because they want to have children. And then you have many, countless, mourning, childless, middle-aged women who bought the lie for years, and now they find themselves alone, childless, and despairing, and grasping for straws to find a means for a partner or a child to please themselves. It's then all about themselves rather than discovering the growth and transformation that occurs when you have a child. And here's the reality. These childless women want more. These unmarried men want more. They're saying they're unhappy. And here's the deal. We have the answer to this crisis. When I say we, the church. that we need to live an abortion-free, pro-marriage, sex aside of marriage, hard work makes you happier mindset within the context of marriage, where you're happier, more fulfilled, and better human beings for having gotten married and had children. You see, God got it right. The church is the last standing institution that has upheld the solution to the psychoanalyzed crisis of the 21st century. And this, my friend, is what you and I are advocating for between now and the official decision by the Supreme Court. Between now and whatever decision may be made in our individual states, if the decision of abortion goes back to our individual states, we have to appeal to the heart issue, the mourning of the culture, the perpetual adolescence, the sorrow, the longing for companionship, the loneliness. Abortion, the sexual revolution, is at the heart of the problem, and a faith-filled perspective on human life, marriage, and intimacy will help people to rediscover happiness, true fulfillment, and becoming better humans yet again. You're listening to Trending with Timree here on Relevant Radio. It's the first week of Advent, and in the face of everything that's occurred recently, I want to touch on the importance of hope. That first purple Advent candle on our Advent wreath that we may have in our homes or see at Mass each Sunday. Well, the first candle actually represents something, represents hope. We've been talking about this all weekend long on Trending. I encourage you to listen to the podcast if you've not heard the importance of this virtue. You see, hope is a virtue, and virtue enhances us as human beings. We love enhancements. Everything from the Apple Watch that helps us to enhance how much we walk, how much we drink, our capacity to communicate with others. We love enhancements when we think of what superhero power we would want if we were one. We even love it as we wear superhero t-shirts, and studies have even shown that when you wear a superhero t-shirt, many people feel more confident when they wear them. We make enhancements all the time with our hair, makeup, clothing, even plastic surgery. But why are we focusing so much on bodily aid and enhancements when we need a supernatural enhancement? And I think that that's where virtue comes in, this virtue of hope that we're focusing on this week. It's a real soul food. You see, hope is a theological virtue. It's infused by grace. It's an absolute gift. We have a natural longing for God instilled in us, and we can have even this natural understanding of hope where we can hope for a good outcome for a job interview, or we can hope for a good outcome on a project we're doing. Now, the thing that we're doing could be good or bad. This is where natural hope comes in. We can hope in not great things. But the supernatural, theological virtue of hope has to do with an orientation toward God, toward fulfillment. Joseph Pieper, the great philosopher and theologian, I love his work, when talking about hope, talked about hope as firmness of orientation aimed directly at supernatural happiness in God. You see, not fleeting, transitory emotion of giddiness, momentary, fleeting happiness based on our desires that have been met. You see, only hope in the theological sense is a virtue. We can practice and work on and try to grow in natural hope and orienting ourselves faithfully toward God, but we need to pray for this virtue as a gift. I'll continue tomorrow here on Trending to unpack the theological virtue of hope, understanding a couple of other virtues that actually go side by side with it, so that as we pray for the great gift of this virtue and the graces to be filled with hope, that we can also work on practical things to make us better predisposed to receive these graces from God. You're listening to Trending with Timree here on Relevant Radio. Tomorrow, I'm also going to address the topic of contraception. Many people will say you want to reduce abortion numbers, just use more contraception. So stay tuned as I'm joined by Dr. Susan Caldwell to talk about why we don't need contraception for our health, to be participating members of society, or to reduce abortion numbers. We hear a lot right now surrounding the topic of abortion, but what about contraception? Everyone seems to think that's the solution. This is Timory from Trending with Timory. Friday, I'll discuss why we do not need access to contraception as women, why it's not a solution to reducing abortion numbers, and why it's just bad for our bodies as women and bad for our relationships. I'll be joined by Dr. Susan Caldwell to address this issue of contraception and our health as well. Join me daily at 6 p.m. Central on Relevant Radio or the Relevant Radio app.